Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI. Welcome to this deep dive. Today we're venturing far from a comfortable civilization. We're heading into the wild, harsh landscape of Jack London's 1903 classic, The Call of the Wild.
Mm-hmm. And it's more than just a great adventure story, isn't it? It's really a key text for American naturalism.
Exactly. And that term naturalism, it's so important here.
It really is. For anyone maybe less familiar, it's this idea that our fate, or, you know, in Buck's case, a dog's fate, is shaped by environment, by heredity. Nature itself doesn't really care. It's indifferent.
Almost like a machine.
Yeah, machine, not some kind of moral force. And London, well, he came by this worldview the hard way.
Oh, absolutely. His life story is incredible. Born poor, basically taught himself everything, and then he spent that brutal year in the Klondike during the gold rush in 97.
He didn't strike gold, did he?
No, no gold. But he came back with something arguably more valuable for his writing. This deep understanding of how cold, how hunger, just strips away all the polite layers we build up.
And you can feel that lived experience on every page. It's so raw. He was also really plugged into the big idea swirling around back then.
Right. You can see traces of Darwin, for sure. Natural selection is everywhere.
And maybe even Marx, with the focus on labor and exploitation, especially with the sled dogs.
And Nietzsche, too. That will to power seems very present, particularly later on.
Definitely. So this story, Buck's story, it becomes this really intense look at what happens when that civilized veneer just cracks wide open. Survival of the fittest, plain and simple.
So our plan today is to trace Buck's journey. He starts as this, well, pampered dog. But his story is a kind of Bildungsroman, a coming-of-age tale.
But twisted, right. Instead of finding his place in society, he finds himself by, like, rejecting it, reverting.
Exactly. It's all about that core tension. The pull of safety and civilization versus this deep, undeniable call from his primal ancestry.
So let's start at the beginning, this fall from grace. Buck's life is, frankly, idyllic. He's the king, the absolute ruler of Judge Miller's estate in sunny California, Santa Clara Valley.
Sounds pretty nice. What kind of dog was he again?
A big, strong mix, St. Bernard and Scotch Shepherd, living a life of, you know, total ease and dignity.
Yeah.
He's respected.
Safe, comfortable, built on trust, but that whole world depends on humans and humans. Well,
humans are the weak link here. The gold rush changes everything. Suddenly there's this huge demand for strong dogs up north. Dogs like Buck.
And that leads to the inciting incident.
Yep. Purely economics and human weakness. Manuel, one of Gardner's helpers with a gambling problem, sees an opportunity.
He steals Buck.
Just lures him away, sells him. Buck ends up crated, terrified, shipped north. He goes from sunshine and respect to darkness and violence instantly.
A total shock. And his education into this new world is immediate and brutal.
First lesson comes from the man in the red sweater. A dog breaker.
Ah, the infamous club scene.
It's foundational. Buck fights back, instinctively. But he learns quickly that challenging that kind of force is futile. It's the law of the club. Submit or be destroyed.
But London makes a point, doesn't he? About Buck's spirit.
Crucially, yes. He was beaten, he knew that, but he was not broken. He submits, physically, but that inner pride, that spark, it's still there. He learns obedience, not respect.
Okay, so that's one kind of law, force from humans. But there's another lesson waiting, isn't there? Even harsher?
Oh, much harsher. He sees Curly, another dog brought north, a friendly Newfoundland, get attacked by a pack of huskies when she makes a mistake, stumbles.
And they just...
They tear her apart. Instantly. No mercy, no hesitation. That's the law of Fang. Weakness equals death. There's no fair play among the dogs themselves in that environment.
So in just a few days, he goes from civilized rules to pure survival calculus. Club and Fang. That's it.
Pretty much. And he adapts incredibly fast. He learns vigilance. He learns suspicion.
Then he gets new masters, Perrault and Francois.
Right. The French-Canadian mail carriers. They're different. They're tough, experienced, and fair in their own way. They understand the North.
And they teach him the practical stuff.
Exactly. How to pull a sled, how to work in a team, how to dig a snow burrow to survive the freezing nights. Basic survival skills for that world.
But it's not just physical skills he learns, is it? There's a moral shift, too.
A huge one. He's constantly hungry, ravenous in a way he never imagined back in California. And that hunger drives him to break his old codes.
He starts stealing food.
Yeah. He learns from another dog, Pike, how to be sneaky, how to raid the camp supplies, steal bacon, snatch food from others. That pampered sense of right and wrong, gone. Replaced by pure, pragmatic survival instinct. Look out for number one, or you starve.
It's a rapid erosion of his civilized morality.
Definitely. Which brings us right to that core idea you mentioned earlier, atavism.
Right. This isn't just learning new tricks. London frames it as Buck remembering something ancient within him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like the wildness was dormant, buried under generations of domestication, and the harshness of the North just awakens it. He starts having these visions, right?
Yeah, these dreams or ancestral memories of a hairy man by a fire, of being a wolfish creature himself. It's biology reasserting itself.
He's not just adapting, he's reverting, becoming that dominant primordial beast the book talks about, shedding his soft past.
And becoming this beast inevitably puts him in conflict with the existing power structure in the dog team.
Absolutely. With Spitz, the lead dog.
Describe Spitz for us.
Spitz is the embodiment of the wild's cruelty almost. A big white husky. Cunning, treacherous, totally merciless. He rules through fear and violence. He is the law of Fang.
So a clash is unavoidable.
Completely. It simmers for hundreds of miles on the trail. Little challenges, fights over scraps, dominance plays. It finally boils over during a chase for a snowshoe rabbit.
It's not even about the rabbit, is it?
Not really. It's about who gets to lead, who's the alpha. The final fight is, well, it's epic. Titanic.
And this is where Buck shows he's different. Spitz fights with brute force and instinct.
Standard husky tactics.
Yeah.
But Buck uses something Spitz doesn't have. Imagination. Intelligence.
How does he win?
He fakes a move, gets inside Spitz's guard, and breaks his legs. Uses cunning, not just strength. Then the rest of the pack, who hated Spitz anyway, they close in. It's brutal, but it's decisive.
A victory earned through smarts as much as savagery.
Exactly. And it cements his transformation. He hasn't just survived, he's mastered this new world. And he knows it.
He demands the lead position immediately, right? Refuses to run anywhere else.
Yep. Perrault and Francois try putting another dog, Sol X, in lead. But Buck won't have it. He makes it clear he is the new leader. His empowerment is huge.
And he turns out to be a good leader.
The best they've ever had, according to the book. He's strict, demands discipline, but he's also fair. He brings order and efficiency to the team. They make record time under him.
But that phase, the mail run, it's not all triumph, is it? There's a darker side to the work itself.
Oh, definitely. After Perrault and Francois, the team is sold to a Scotch half-breed mail carrier. And the work becomes this relentless, soul-crushing grind.
Just endless miles, heavy loads, day after day.
Yeah, it wears them down physically and mentally. It's sheer industrialized labor in the harshest conditions. You really feel the indifference of the system. The dogs are just cogs in the machine.
And we see the toll it takes, like with the dog Dave.
Ah, Dave. That's heartbreaking. His entire identity, his pride, is tied up in pulling the sled. When he gets too sick, too weak to work.
He insists on staying in the harness.
Right up until the end. He literally dies pulling. He has no concept of life outside that labor. It's quite tragic.
That whole section really shows the exhausting reality behind the adventure. And that exhaustion, that decline, leads them to their worst masters yet.
Oh, Hal, Charles and Mercedes, the unholy trinity from the South.
Utterly clueless.
Worse than clueless. They represent civilization at its absolute worst. Arrogant, ignorant, cruel, and completely unprepared for the realities of the North. They overload the sled, mismanage food.
And they blame the dogs for their own incompetence.
Constantly beating them out of frustration. It's a terrible, abusive relationship. They embody everything wrong with how some humans interact with nature and animals.
And this leads to the real turning point for Buck, doesn't it? When they try to cross the melting ice.
Yes. Spring is coming. The ice is dangerously thin. Thornton, a seasoned prospector, warns them. But they're too arrogant to listen.
And Buck.
Buck senses the danger. His instincts scream no. He refuses to get up, refuses to lead the team onto the cracking ice, even when Hal starts beating him mercilessly.
He chooses defiance, rooted in that primal instinct over obedience to incompetent humans.
And just as Hal is about to kill him, John Thornton steps in.
The savior.
Literally. He cuts Buck free. And moments later, Hal, Charles, Mercedes, the sled, the rest of the dog team, they all plunge through the ice and disappear. Gone.
Thornton represents something completely different then.
He's the ideal master, maybe even the ideal human in this story. He's kind, understanding, respects Buck. He embodies a connection based not on force, but on, well, love.
And this is new for Buck.
Totally new. London writes, love, genuine, passionate love, was his for the first time. It's this incredibly deep bond. It anchors Buck, pulls him back towards the human world, even as the Wild calls him.
And Buck shows incredible loyalty in return.
Unbelievable loyalty. He saves Thornton from drowning in rapids. And then there's that legendary feat in Dawson.
The bet. Pulling the 1,000-pound sled.
Yeah. Pulling 1,000 pounds of flour on a frozen sled, breaking it free just through sheer will and strength, all for Thornton, wins a huge wager. Makes Buck famous throughout the Yukon.
But even with this deep love, this connection, the call doesn't go away.
No, it gets stronger. That's the core tension of the final part. He loves Thornton deeply, but the wilderness is pulling him. He starts taking longer trips away from camp, runs with a wild wolf for a while.
He feels the kinship.
Deeply. But he always comes back. Thornton's campfire, that symbol of human connection and safety, it keeps drawing him back.
Until Thorne takes him even deeper into the wilderness.
Right. Thornton and his partners go searching for a legendary lost gold mine, way off the beaten path. And out there, Buck becomes fully wild.
The master hunter emerges.
Oh, yeah. The book details this incredible days-long hunt where Buck stalks and finally brings down a massive bull moose. He's operating entirely on instinct now, a true predator.
Living on the edge between two worlds, but that connection to Thornton still holds him.
It does, until it's violently severed.
The Yeehat attack.
Buck returns from hunting to find the camp destroyed. Thornton, his partners, all killed by a group of Yeehat Indians.
And Buck's reaction?
Pure, unadulterated rage. It's terrifying. He attacks the Yeehats, kills several of them his first time killing humans. It's not defense, it's vengeance. Primal fury unleashed.
That act breaks the final tie.
Completely, as London puts it. The last tie was broken. Man and the claims of man no longer bound him. There's nothing holding him back now.
So he answers the call, definitively.
He finds the local wolf pack, has a fierce fight to prove his dominance, because he's not just joining, he's leading, and then he vanishes into the wilderness with them. He becomes the ghost dog, a legend whispered about by the Yeehats.
A complete transformation. Back to the wild, but there's that final detail.
Return. Yeah, it's poignant. Every year, he comes back to the valley, to the place where Thornton died, and mourns. A lone wolf howling. It shows that capacity for love, that bond. It wasn't erased. It just exists alongside his wildness now.
So, pulling it all together for you listening, the novel really hammers home how thin that veneer of civilization can be. Environment, instinct, they're incredibly powerful forces.
And morality becomes relative, doesn't it? In the wild, the good choice is the one that helps you survive. Nature doesn't judge, it just is. The law of club and fang rules.
London's writing style, that close third-person focus on Buck's thoughts and feelings, makes that transformation feel so real, so immediate.
Yeah, you're right inside Buck's head as he changes. It makes you really ponder which self is the true one. The comfortable, domesticated creature.
Or the fiercely independent being, shaped by hardship. It's a powerful question about freedom. And maybe about finding strength by embracing those wilder parts of ourselves.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.